Hey, Todd. Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can.
That was weird. But having the kind of shared meeting, you know, I got in 3 or 4 minutes early and ended up on the last call, and then it ended and I got dropped. And so anyway.
I entered the call as it ended. So I'm going in and says, this meeting's ended.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, really. I promise not to listen much.
What was the previous meeting? Anything good?
Wasn't it one of the fabric meetings?
Oh, okay.
It's an open call anyway, so there's...
Yeah. I know, it was just weird.
Yeah. It's also weird if you cannot get in if people lock you out because they don't leave. So I choose this weird over the other weird.
So I am adding everybody I know or can see in the list to the meeting notes. So if I miss you, please feel free to go over.
Okay, my name's Incog Ito.
Whatever. You know, the interesting thing about Vipin, do you like change where you connect from and how you connect? Because you're in the participants list, yours bounces around, and it's you, Vipin, but yours bounces around on my screen all over the place in the ordering on the list. So anyway, is it supposed to be like alphabetical? That may be the reason. All right. Okay, so I think Hart was still planning on joining as well. Top level things. This is part of Hyperledger. We are all covered by antitrust responsibilities. Don't participate in any non-competitive behavior, anti-competitive behavior on this call, please. Be nice. All right.
It doesn't say be nice. It just says don't participate in anti.
Yeah. Well, be competitively, be institutionally nice. How's that work? You know, behave yourselves and, you know, don't participate in anti-competitive behavior. How's that? There you go.
There it is.
So it's actually kind of interesting. I don't know how it is with you, but we have these mandatory training classes that we have to take, and probably 3/4 of them are about antitrust related things. Just, you know, this is not how you talk to a customer. This is not how you talk to a vendor. You know, all of those things.
Well, with the kind of market dominance that you guys have,
we have to be very, very careful.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's the key. You know, if you didn't have that, then you probably wouldn't be spending 75% of your time talking about
it. Yeah. Anyway, so a couple of things for today. Continue to work on the paper. But before we do that, I wanted to, okay, this is where I get to, you know, the time I put into this gives me at least some right to say nice things. We just pushed the private data objects code earlier this week into the Hyperledger Labs repository. And that technology is specifically designed to provide a number of facilities and services and capabilities for doing smart contract execution that preserves, to the extent we can, the confidentiality of all of the data that's in the contract, and allows exchange the contract off-chain so that the details with commitment on-chain, so that the details of the contract itself can be maintained confidential between the parties as well. I would be happy
to go through. Hey, folks, Ram here.
Hey, Ram. I'd be happy to go through kind of more detailed stuff on that in a later meeting, or I will plan on making a link available to an overview paper that we have almost completed. It's pretty rough around. It's done, but it's pretty rough around the edges. So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. The reason is that next week, there's going to be the ZK Proofs standards meeting in Boston. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether any of this work would inform or otherwise influence that standards meeting. And I don't know whether anybody from Intel is there. I think so. I mean, there are 70 participants, so, you know, probably. But they may not be aware of your PDO stuff.
Yeah, and our approach is almost completely about using the TEE rather than zero knowledge approaches. So, I mean, we're to the point now that, and these are the kind of questions that I'm hoping we'll be able to provide framework for answering through this group. But we're to the point now, for example, where we send a message into an enclave. It's essentially it's a fully encrypted message. So with the termination point inside the enclave, so even the helper process on the machine can't see the contents of it. And what we're trying to decide right now, for example, is so we send state of the contract in, state in theory on a successful operation comes back out. On an unsuccessful operation, should we send a bogus state? Because the size of the message reveals information about the status of the operation, for example. So we've been having those kind of discussions about whether or not we need to and how much we need to protect, even from that form of kind of side channel.
If you remember, we had that same discussion led by Hart, I believe, about three meetings ago.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it was brought home very, very concretely when I had to figure out in the code whether or not, you know, the decision we had in the code was, for example, do we just copy the incoming state into the outgoing state, even though it was a failed operation? Which doesn't really hurt anything semantically. But it's potentially a big impact on efficiency because it's a lot more data that has to be processed by the client in order to discover that the operation failed. So we're finding a lot of places where, obviously, you know, the core confidentiality has to be preserved. But these edge cases where we have these side channels, there's a pretty substantial trade-off between performance and sort of fine-grained confidentiality that has a pretty big impact on system throughput for complicated contracts. So trying to come up with a framework in which we can actually do the evaluation as to whether or not those services are necessary.
Also, I mean, I don't quite get it. You're saying that other than the use of network resources, you'd also need more processor resources or other kinds of resources to figure out the operation failed or succeeded?
Let me back up. The idea behind the private data objects is that we provision encryption keys into a set of enclaves. Those encryption keys are known only to the enclaves. that are provisioned, right? So even the owner of the contract does not have the right to decrypt the state of the contract. So the only place that the state can be decrypted is inside the enclave. So an operation then is performed by taking a copy of the encrypted state, passing it in with an operation that you want to perform on that state into the enclave. The enclave performs the operation, and a lot of these operations are policy-based. So it might be I send something in, but I don't have the right to perform that operation. So I can get a result back that says, no, you don't have the right to perform that operation. That response coming back, it in that situation is no big deal. An observer sitting on the outside could see that the message that came back from the enclave was substantially smaller than something that would include state, so that they can know the operation failed, right? But if we send the state back, it's just consuming a bunch of network resources and other resources for doing transportation and coding and a bunch of other things that are necessary.
Okay. It would be pretty simple to see that the operation failed for the consumer, but since you're attaching all this stuff along in order to obscure the result from
From side channels. In theory, it's not a big deal, but it does have a pretty substantial impact on throughput on transactions if you've got to copy a fairly substantial size state into your output as a result of it. So even things like the size of the result, and I mean, right now we're just basically saying, screw this, we're not going to send the state back. We don't have applications yet where we justify the level of confidentiality that would be required for that particular side channel obfuscation. So, but the irony for me was that, in the coding of a lot of these things, we've over the last couple of months as we've kind of matured the code, a lot of the decisions that we've been talking about in this meeting have been very, very concrete in the kind of things we're trying to do with obfuscating and hiding.
So this brings us back to the discussion as we left it last week, last time, which is will the banks pay for what will the banks pay for heightened confidentiality, and will that be necessary? Meaning, obscuring side channel attacks. How much, what is the business case for that? Which was essentially the question we asked last week, I believe, right?
Yeah, I guess my question is, though, is that our job to figure that out, or is our job to point out what these are and to lay out what the options are to address them?
Yeah. I mean, in the end, you can always say, you can do this, and it'll cost you X. And if you do Y, it'll cost you Y, something else.
I think it's important that we identify those things. The only reason I bring this up is because I've just been going around with the Fabric guys around this side database stuff that they have. And they, it was meant for privacy, but it just leaks a whole lot of information. And the response was sort of, well, this is what we did because this is what our use case was. And it's like, I get the value in looking at concrete use cases, but it seems like we need to be able to step back and go, wait a minute, we can see that this leaks information, and there are probably applications where that's important to know or to prevent.
Maybe not. Some levels, right? You can't really provide concrete numbers.
I'm not looking for numbers. What I'm looking for is what is the kind of information that any particular mechanism leaks, right? So they provide a mechanism to hide the values of keys, but they leak all the key information. Right? And that may not be obvious to somebody who's trying to apply this technology.
Yes, that I agree.
But is that part of our charter, and is that part of this discussion, or do we, or is it partly, is it to go so far as to say, you know, let's figure out what the business case is, like, because I think that's going way beyond what we should be looking at.
No. I didn't mean what the business case is. What you know, I think the question that was asked last time of me and probably you was, you know, what, how far do the users want to take it, you know, some kind of a reality check. It doesn't mean that we'll close off all avenues. At least that was my understanding. Correct me if I'm wrong, my heart and Mick, you guys.
This is where I get to go back and say, you know, in some sense, this is why the ideal model is important, because it allows you to articulate what those requirements are. So I think what you're hearing from me this morning, and I think what you were hearing from Hart and others 2 weeks ago, is there are a lot of options that we can use to define what correct behavior is. So for example, we can start with a notion of correct behavior simply that you can't see or interpret, that an external observer cannot interpret the messages that are being sent in the system. Right, that's yeah. One level, right? That's a simple one. A second level might be that observing the message does not provide any information about what message was performed or what the results are of that message. So for example, in my case, the size of the message in this case is a good indicator of at least success or failure. So there is a side channel, unless we do the obfuscation by sending back some copy of state along with the response, which would allow us to address that concern about, for example, the size of the message leaking information. The third level would be, can you see the messages at all? Because right now the existence of messages indicates that there's communication happening between the parties. And I think some of what we were talking about with the kind of broadcast techniques that Hart was describing for the trusted third party allows us to remove some of that information. So I really want to come back to what you said in a minute, because I think that there's something important there in for the requirements piece of this. But I think the question that we're asking those of you who have the detailed information about the usage is, what is the right, what is the ideal behavior? I mean, again, there's an implicit understanding that we have to support some level of functionality, and we have to, at some level, make this operational. You know, we can't start with some notion of some exponential communication protocol that's going to kill us before we even get started. But sort of within bounds of some level of reason, what's the right set of requirements, for example, for these side channels? So having said that, Todd, can I come back to something you said? Because this was really interesting. So can you tell me a little bit more, can you explain a little more about what it is that seems to work and what it is that seems to not work with the new fabric approach?
Well, the issue that we're looking at is that we looked at that because we want to use that. I mean, it's being added, or it's already in 1.1, or at least experimental.
Yep.
And what surprised us is that I guess we had looked at different approaches, and we had looked at the fact that you would basically exchange with the ordering service only a hash of the read-write set.
Mm-hmm.
And what that causes is potentially some problems around validation, and we'll get into that later. But what's surprising to us is that it leaks all the information about what keys were accessed in a transaction. And that just seems to us to leak an awful lot of information because the order and everybody on the channel sees all that information. And so unless you want to go to these sort of bilateral channels or whatever, which just doesn't scale, you have people sharing this communication channel and now you're disclosing a bunch of information on it. And that's just, at least from some of the use cases we're looking at, that's not acceptable. I mean, I guess it depends upon how you choose your keys, but you know, if you want semantically preserving keys, then you leak a bunch of stuff. And so, go ahead.
No, I was just for clarity's sake. So the change set is hashed, but the keys that are modified are included in it?
No, the read write set is not hashed. All that's hashed are the values.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So
that
I can't
wasn't how
see the
I
values.
Thought it worked.
Nah, okay. That's how it works. So you hash the values, which is cool. But anyway, the whole read write set, as far as all the keys that are involved in the transaction, are exposed. And we can envision and actually have some use cases where that would be disclosing way too much information.
Yeah, it depends entirely on how you use the keys for that.
True. But then you push the problem back onto the application. If you push the problem back onto the application.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this was great to hear, because I also assumed that just reading about the feature that the key, the whole set.
That was my assumption. Exactly.
Because we're looking, without going into too much detail, at that feature as solving the problem that we had, which we solved by creating a series of bilateral channels, that this will resolve it. But this is entirely unacceptable, basically, having that information. I think it defeats the purpose of having the feature.
Right, and I guess that's what I see the purpose of this working group is here, is that, you know, that it should have been obvious to everybody that this fundamentally lacks some privacy-preserving capabilities. Right, because I would like to say, wait, before this kind of stuff gets added for a special, it was added, as far as I can tell, for a special use case, which is also why they apparently they age out the data out of the side database, even though it doesn't get aged out of the ledger. And it would be nice to be able to have some guidelines that say, hey, if you're going to do this kind of stuff, you need to make it explicitly clear what are the implications from privacy and confidentiality.
So let me just, I want to drive a little bit of clarity here to make sure I understand, because I'm like Stan, I read the write-up on it and I had a very different takeaway on what was happening. So with the private data objects, what goes into the ledger right now is a SHA-256 hash of the encrypted state that was input into the transaction, a SHA-256 hash of the state that is the output of the exchange, a SHA-256 of the message, a contract identifier, which allows it to be ground or rooted in sort of serialization of a particular contract. So that's the piece of information. The transaction is signed and submitted by a one-time key. So there's no correlation on submissions of the transactions. And there's a signature from the enclave that performed the computation that verifies that the enclave did it. And that's the only stuff we put in the ledger. That's the only stuff we require to be put in the ledger.
When you say contract identifier, do you mean some kind of a metadata about the contract or the contract itself?
It's just an identifier for, the final thing is the hash of the contract code. There's a contract. The contract identifier basically says, in this context, anything that modifies this has to be done serially. There has to be a single linear path of modifications for this object.
Okay, so it's kind of a something that identifies that particular
object.
Okay.
Yeah, in our case, it definitely is an object, but yeah.
There's some kind of a provenance.
Yes. Yep. And it just ensures serialization of it, so.
Okay, but what about if you're exchanging some regular, let's say, something that is modeled, let's say cash or bonds or whatever, are there those references to those kind of objects all subsumed under the hash that you put on?
Yes.
And so that it doesn't, those things are never revealed.
Yeah. And in fact, we call our ledger a commit log because it's not, it really doesn't have any semantics other than kind of, in our case, it's graph building. So it's a separate commitment to a transaction, but all of the details of what actually happened are off-chain.
Looks like a lot of people are going to this model, you know? DAH is GSL is somewhat similar.
Yeah, well, in fact, we were very much inspired by the GSL, and you know, this gives us a nice implementation of some of the capabilities of the GSL.
So essentially, your ledger basically just contains a proof that this happened, right? It doesn't contain any detail.
And because it's graph building, it allows us to do dependencies between changes, so that we get something that looks like database transactions that I can get. Don't commit this unless these following other contracts have committed something that corresponds to it. So the dependency checking becomes critical for coordinating updates between contracts, which turns out to be very powerful. But again, all it exposes is dependencies. It doesn't expose details.
Say that again. I mean,
I have a. Yes. Let me give a concrete example that we can use for this, right? So I may have one object, which is a representation for a balance sheet. I have somebody has some asset that's recorded on that balance sheet. They may come in and say, I want to use this asset as a bid in an auction. And that auction requires me to escrow the asset, to prove ownership of the asset. So this person goes to the balance sheet and says, record the fact that this asset is being escrowed to an auction object over off to the side. So that auction that asset gets escrowed, and the person gets as a result gets a proof of escrow. That proof of escrow is handed then to the auction contract, the auction object. The auction object basically says, I will accept this bid only if the transaction that escrowed the asset is committed to the ledger before my transaction is committed to the ledger. So there's a dependency between the commitments and the two objects. And so our ledger allows us to do this sort of abstract representation of these transactions, and basically the commitment of the auction accepting the bid expresses a dependency that you only are allowed, that the ledger can only commit this update if the balance sheet has committed the escrow transaction.
So what is the handle for the escrow proof?
It's that contract. Yeah, it's the contract ID plus the state hash.
Okay.
So again, the dependency doesn't record anything. I mean, it basically says there's a relationship between these two things, but it doesn't expose any of the details what's in that relationship.
Well.
So again, this kind of goes back to Todd's point. I thought we were implementing, well, I thought we had come to the same end that Fabric had with moving nothing but hashes onto the ordering service. But it sounds like it's not quite the same.
Well, it also feels though that the dependency graph, just the graph even without the transaction details, is still
it still exposes information.
It still exposes information. Yeah.
Yep.
But it's exposing information about the business process, right? Not about the details of who or what.
Correct.
I
totally, Stan, I completely agree with you. And we've looked at different ways in which we could remove even that. I can do some techniques with obfuscating based on sort of follow-on commitments, but it becomes, I mean, this kind of goes back to, it makes the application really challenging to write.
No, it makes sense that you would have this because it helps with like an independent party validation of the ledger integrity.
Right.
That makes perfect sense. So you don't have to rely on like ZKPs and like. It just that it does...
It does leak information.
And yep. which goes back to the stuff we're discussing about the traffic analysis.
Yeah. So where is that? How do you determine? And this has become a very, very, and I think this is in some sense the core of your question, Todd, is how do you decide where to put the dial on hiding information, removing side channels versus expressiveness and performance? I mean, those seem to be the things that are at odds with one another here.
Yeah, I agree. But I'm not sure it's our group's responsibility to figure out where to put that dial. I think it's our group's responsibility to identify. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think it's perfectly okay to just to say, you know, here are the options. If you go down this path, this is the cost, this is the benefit, right? So, at some point, you know, people who are building products are going to decide, you know, how much of this they want to do, and the folks who are implementing it are going to decide, building actual blockchain solutions are going to decide how much they want to pay for it, right?
But in this case, there are also limits, right? You're basically saying the solution that you implemented, when you use that dial, cannot go past the dependencies being exposed.
Yeah, and so this is where I go back to what I think Hart was trying to lead us to. And Hart, feel free to stand up for yourself. I'm going to speak for you for a moment, though. But I think what Hart was trying to get us to was a way of articulating what the specific requirements are. We can define in the ideal system, in a sense, what we want the behavior to be. And then we can do an evaluation of a particular technology against whether or not it meets the criteria that go along with that prescribed behavior. Okay, now Hart, you've been really quiet, so this is where I get to, you know, I'm speaking for you, so feel free to speak for yourself.
That was good, and it's been good to listen to everybody. You're exactly right. The whole point of what I was trying to do is basically, if I just give you a system, right, it's very hard for me to say, like, what is leaked, you know, what's the impact of traffic analysis? What's the impact of side channels, like the size of, you know, the message? Or, you know, a lot of systems, as Mick points out, will have different behaviors, whether something, you know, something fails or succeeds, and, you know, maybe a clever adversary can use this to trick a system into leaking information that it shouldn't, or something like that. And so, yeah, this whole thing is just about trying to find a way where it's easy for someone analyzing the system to figure out what guarantees it gives regarding things like these side channels. So right, if I just give you the system decryption, you can say things easily like, oh, the data is always encrypted, or, you know, the hashes are only, you know, we only see hashes of things, but it really doesn't tell you, you know, it tells you some about the security, it's not the complete picture, right? You know, you can design pathological systems where you do all of these things, the system is totally insecure, right? You know, I could say, for instance, encrypt, you know, a series of a bunch of transactions, and I could have, I could use them to, you know, spell out a key or something like that. So you have to be careful with these system guarantees. And this is actually very practical with things like traffic analysis. So yes, the goal of this, the TLDR of what I've just said is, it's hard to analyze systems and just looking at the system, figure out what exactly the practical security guarantees are. And what I've been trying to explain with this ideal model is a way to do this and to show the system's guarantees in a way that's easy to understand. Does that explain things clearly?
I think when Mick started talking about the ideal model and its justification, I fully agree with all of those things. You know, I never disagreed with the idea behind creating ideal model. But then when we start deviating from that into going to start talking about fabric, the way they've implemented certain things, and now it turns out that there is a limit to that. And there's a limit to the PDO stuff. There's limits to all of these things. Unless the basic construction of the ledger completely, you know, I wouldn't say ideal, but, you know, watertight in some ways, that doesn't reveal this stuff to the outsiders for any kind of analysis, which you may say is the ideal system, but there are systems that try to do that, probably at great cost, you know, like efficiency-wise and all that.
Well,
like Corda, for example, does try to do that. I don't know how practical it would be to, you know, to have a huge network with hundreds of participating nodes with these kind of Corda channels or whatever you want to call them between them.
It's totally okay though, Vipin, for the ideal model to basically leak traffic analysis. Like, you might decide that that's what you want. You might decide, hey, I don't care, you know, there's a ton of traffic anyway, we're just going to leak traffic analysis. You know, we're going to leak the traffic patterns. That's okay. You can do that, and that will be reflected in the ideal model. Like, that's totally okay. You can pick your ideal model so that, you know, traffic patterns are revealed. That's fine. The point is that, you know, just using the ideal model simplifies this, and it allows people to, like, clearly see that, you know, traffic patterns are revealed. And if they're okay with that, and if they want to, you know, obviously everything in life and blockchain is a trade-off between, you know, efficiency and security. And so what this is about is just allowing people to make clear and correct decisions between these two.
So what is the value? What's the value of an ideal model that leaks stuff?
Well, it allows people to see that stuff is being leaked, right? So what I want is I design this complicated blockchain, right? And I reduce it to something simple. I say the security properties of this extremely complicated blockchain, which is very difficult to analyze, are the same as this other system that's really simple, right? And you can look at this simple system and say, aha, these are exactly the security properties. This is exactly what I get. And you can just know. Whereas if you look at this, like, complicated, you know, chain system, it's, you know, you might not know what you get, right? It's the same kind of idea as a cryptographic proof, right? Where you take a, you know, complicated, say, encryption or signature or whatever, and say, okay, well, this reduces from this, like, simple mathematical assumption, right? And if, you know, that's easy to look at, you know, might be deep, but it's much simpler than kind of looking at a whole crypto system and analyzing it, right? Does that make sense,
Tom? That makes sense. I guess the question is then, do we have multiple ideal models then?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no one ideal model. You pick your ideal model is just, it's essentially an easy way. It's a way to represent your security properties, right?
Exactly.
I get that. Yeah.
Right. So Todd, think of it as a way, ideal in this case is a system that meets your requirements. You know, give us a system, give us a description or a definition of a system that meets your requirements for security and confidentiality.
That's what I think people have been thinking. At least I've been thinking that when you talk about ideal, it's either everything's abstracted away or it's perfect. And it's like, this is sort of it's not either of those.
Yeah. Actually, the term is
two ideas about this ideal model. One is the one that just said, which is an ideal model is truly ideal. The other is reducing a complex system into a model that removes the complexity, abstracts it out, and then creates a model which can be analyzed easily. So that's one aspect of it. The other, and the other one, in fact, Mick came up with, which is a slightly different angle on it, which is the requirements driving the ideal model, not the actual implementation driving the ideal model. But in both cases, it is mapping a real world example into something simplified so that we can understand it in terms of the security properties, and we can map the security properties easily into this model. But, the one that Todd is talking about, and which I was harping on the last one, was the ideal model in the sense that we do not sacrifice any properties just because fabric doesn't do it, or just because sawtooth doesn't do it. Simple.
Yeah, I get that. I think we were both thinking along the lines of that this is like, the perfect model, if you will. And I get where you're going with this, Hart. And I guess my question then would be is then, how do we, well, let's say we pick one of these, and here are the properties and the privacy that it preserves. How do we figure out whether a given implementation matches that model?
That's the next step, right? That's the hard part, right? That's like the part that corresponds to the cryptographic proof, right? So that's kind of where all the work goes in, right?
Yeah.
And that's not always easy, and it shouldn't be, right? So that's where you help the people trying to analyze the security of the system. And why do we, going back to the kind of the crypto assumption world, right? So if I have an encryption and I have an encryption scheme, right? I reduce it to something like, say DDH, right? Which is the decisional Diffie-Hellman assumption. And that's nice. And we would like to do things like that for blockchain, but we have all these things, like all these traffic analysis problems, and they're really hard to write down, right? If I asked you to write down what is leaked from a traffic analysis attack, right? Well, it would really depend on kind of, the patterns of the scheme, right? And how the system was used. If I knew Mick's key and I was only allowed to send encrypted information, right? I could send his key in Morse code where dot was long and dash was short or something, right? And if you knew I was doing that, then, that would totally compromise the security of the scheme, right? So it's really hard to give proper guarantees about these systems, which is why we have to kind of resort to this.
Okay, I'm on board.
Pippin?
I see where you're coming from, but I still have my doubts about the efficacy of this method. I basically agree with you that in order to analyze the system that exists, yes, we need to reduce it to this quote unquote ideal model and come up with ways of looking at what it leaks. And if this is the way which we are proceeding, we have to be very open-minded or open-sighted about what actually we are doing, you know? That's all I want. I'm not saying, you know, that we go for something that is absolutely perfect, absolutely ideal, but we have to just look at actually what actually we are doing. I mean, that's it, very simply put. So this is what's possible in this world right now. So let's go for it. I mean, you know, I want something to come out of this this group. I mean, we've already spent quite a bit of time on certain, you know, all these concepts, and I believe we have produced some useful work. And let's get on with it then.
I mean, yeah, I'm happy with what's gone on so far. I think just, you know, having everybody be on the same page about security and how to analyze it is really important. But yeah, I mean, ideally we can write something. And if we do, you know, we can write something pretty, pretty interesting. So I'm going to suggest that the way to start is we want to make it easier for ourselves, right? We don't want to start with the hard problems. We want to start with the easy problems and work our way to the hard problems. So I suggest we start writing with we give ourselves very, very powerful tools. And I'm thinking, what am I thinking, Mick? I'm thinking we give ourselves sort of private data object capabilities, right?
Okay.
Which is essentially like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're basically assuming a VBB oracle?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So if we assume...
By the way, let me just... Okay, this is called the antitrust, whatever it is. But, you know, we also make the assumption that enclaves can be compromised so that we know that there are backdoors. But we'll deal with that part separately. Okay, so...
Yeah, but for the
practical implementation...
Sorry, everybody, for throwing out a technical term. A VBB oracle is what's called a virtual black box oracle. So it means that there's like something that you can't possibly compromise, that you send it something and it does something and then it sends something back, but you have no idea what's going on inside. So hence why it's a virtual black box.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to everybody?
So that's a very different usage of the term oracle than like Corda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
this from the guy who works for Oracle? Nice.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Shall we go down that path? No, never mind. Sorry. That's a big distraction. No. Anyway, sorry, go ahead. Keep going, Hart.
No, so... Yeah, so if we start with this, so if we imagine kind of all of our nodes are have these like VBB oracles, basically, so that like, you know, if I'm running a blockchain node, Vipin can send a transaction to me and it goes straight to the VBB oracle. You know, maybe I can block the transaction from coming in, but I can't like see what's in the transaction I can't like modify it or falsely reject it or something like that, right? I can only kind of cut the wires or redirect or do things like that, right? So I think this is a good start. This is a good first use case, as this will simplify a lot of things and allow us to look at the kind of, you know, these side channel things and what we should care about. And I actually think there's room to write a pretty serious academic paper around this. So I don't know how people feel about that. But to my knowledge, this is not something that has even been studied really well academically.
So let me take the last 10 minutes then and come back to what I think the sort of operational issues of this group, which is, you know, we've been having these conversations now for what, 4 months, 4.5 months, 5 months, something like that. We know that producing deliverables is always a challenge when you're only doing something every couple of weeks for an hour. What would people think about a face-to-face to actually write up a first draft of this paper? It's easy for me to get down to the Bay Area. You know, if I don't, Ram, I don't want to volunteer you, but you've been very convenient in the past about, you know, providing facilities at times. And I know Hart's in the area. Are there others who would be able to make like May 18th or May 25th or, you know, pick a date?
I meant to tell you this earlier. So I previously said okay to May 25th.
Uh-huh.
I think May 25th is Bay Area Crypto Day.
Okay.
So
some other time that, but some other time that yeah. would work. Yeah.
And by the way, if you are in the Bay Area and you want to like talk to the crypto people in the Bay and see some talks, you're welcome to come.
Yeah, I'd be happy to host if folks are ready to come to San Jose.
It just, at this point, it feels like the only way we're going to get that we need to make more of a time commitment in order to get to the point where we can get the paper put together. And you know, I'm happy to set up a, you know, if we do something like that, maybe we can set up a Zoom meeting or whatever it is to make it possible to incorporate others who can't travel. Although doing a Zoom meeting for an hour is much different than trying to do it for, you know, 4 or 5 when you're actually trying to write something. So the face-to-face is useful. How do people feel about that? And are there other places where we might all be? I don't want to push it all the way out. I can't go to Amsterdam. I've got conflicts. I could send a couple of people on my team that could do the work there. But I also don't want to wait until the end of June in order to make this happen. Are others available enough to do this? Or would you be, you know, would it be okay for a group of us to get together from the West Coast, put something together, and then use that as sort of a basis for future discussions?
Yeah, I'd be fine with you guys doing that. I can't do something that week. That's not an option for me. It needs to be in person, but I could do something if we were to do a day-long meeting. I could do something remotely if that would work. I realize that remote is more difficult, but, you know, if most of the people are in the room and I'm just listening on the wall, I can certainly interject as appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Same with me. You know, traveling is often not an option around here. Blockchain is in the working towards the slough of Death Pond over here, you know, in the bank. So, yeah, I can participate as much as I can over the remote.
Okay.
As long as it doesn't conflict with something else happening here, which I don't think. The week of May 18th, I mean, that particular week, I think there's consensus happening here, but.
Yeah, there is.
I've got a bunch of other conflicts. I was thinking the week before Memorial Day. That one's convenient for me because I'm going to be in the Bay Area on Friday anyway. But if Hart's got the conflict, it's easy for me to travel down to the Bay Area.
Yeah, I think I'm free days that week other than that Friday. But if Mick, if you are there, you should show up to Bay Area Crypto Day.
My wife might have a problem if I skip my grandkids' birthday party.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah, and that's the problem. That's the problem I'm facing. My wife's having knee surgery. I can't go that week. So,
Bay Area crypto would be a lot of fun. However, this would not be political. You know, I can pull 4 or 5 hours out early in the day, but it's not going to be a full day thing. So, sorry. This is where reality sits in. Let me send an email out to the Architecture Working Group mailing list and just propose a couple of days in there, and let's just see whether or not we can make it work. So I am not a fan of continuous discussion. And I think we're to the point now where we've put enough thinking into this that it's time to get a lot more concrete. So,
yeah, I agree. One question I have, this is procedural maybe, is how do we pull somebody in from the Fabric team?
That's a good question.
I mean, because I can't say I represent them. I mean, I'm not a maintainer, and so I believe that's a missing piece here. I think we should have their contribution, but I don't know how you do that.
Todd, I think the big issue is most of the people that work heavily on the security and crypto aspects are in Zurich.
Right. Yeah, I know.
So, yeah.
This is why we have to have the crypto library meeting at the crack of dawn.
okay.
So,
I don't know, but this is something maybe we should push on Chris, you know, or somebody to say, you know, they need somebody who's part of the maintenance of Fabric to be participating in this, because they are conspicuously absent, I think.
Well, we really want like Marco or Manu or somebody like that, right?
That would be ideal. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we want someone who has a fairly academic background. And also works on Fabric. And these people do exist. And they are
good. How do we elevate that? You know, do we take that to Chris and say, as part of the TSC, you know, push somebody? I know he has dual roles because he also works for IBM, but...
I don't know, and I don't know that Chris can compel these people to work. They're in, like, the IBM research in Zurich. So it's not clear that Chris can say, like, hey, you have to show up for this meeting, right?
Compel. Maybe, that's an interesting word.
Maybe we can use multiple avenues. Some of those guys are also going to be in the ZK Proofs workshop. I'll try talking to them.
Yeah, I think a more grassroots effort is probably better. The work. I have tried asking Chris for overall participation from the Fabric team on the architecture work group, and you know, it hasn't quite panned out yet.
I mean, the easiest way to get these guys to do it is to probably, my incentives are in this direction too. Is if we tell them that we want to write an academic paper. Because that will get the research team involved.
Okay.
Okay. okay, I like it.
If we do that, then they'll get excited.
Publish or perish. Huh?
Yeah, basically.
Mostly we are perishing around here.
So Mick, does that fall on you to push this, or I'll push this, or
I will? I'll send a note to. The IBM team. And Hart, okay. If you're okay, I'll CC you on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's always nice to, you know, claim to be coming from the brains of the operation. So that's why I have to have Hart on there.
This is like the mad cow brains of the operation. The prions have gone haywire.
Well, you know what you can do instead is tell them that, you know, if they don't want to show up, that Oracle will represent them.
Ooh. Reminder that this call is being recorded.
Does anyone go through
I didn't imply anything about that. Come on.
Does anyone go through these calls? I imagine you could, if you like, took a clever splice, you could find some pretty funny stuff.
I'm sure you could. It would be a blast. We should try that sometime. Not. All right. So we are at time. I'll send emails out about times, and I'll send a note to the IBM guys and see if we can get a little bit more participation. So, okay.
Awesome.
All right.
Yeah, I'll do the same. I have some IBM contacts as well, so I'll push on them to get some participation. So.
All right. Thanks, all. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye. Ciao.